Hey guys, welcome again to the forum where science comes to socialize. We're your hosts, Aubrey, Barbara, and Cleo.
But you could be a part of this group and hear your comments on air. Don't forget to get involved with the conversation by tweeting us at ISGPTweets with hashtag ISGPForum.
Or hit us up on our Facebook page.
And check out our website to see what the ISGP is all about and to find more ways to get involved. Today, we're discussing the topics of water, energy, and the subsidies that support them.
Specifically, we're looking at a paper written by Christopher Thornburg and Dustin Streeter for our ICAP series conference entitled Sustainability Challenges, Coping with Less Energy and Water. This conference was held in June of 2015 at the PIH Health Hospital in Whittier, California.
What is an ICAP conference, you ask? Well, these programs are jointly planned by ISGP staff and groups of volunteers from a specific town. Towns are selected based on their high or low level of concern for climate change-related issues, usually due to their geographical location. Accordingly, the conference theme is chosen by the volunteer group and relates in some way to climate change,
making Whittier, California an ideal candidate.
Right. So regarding today's paper, Dr. Thornburg is the founding partner at Beacon Economics, and Mr. Schrader is Beacon Economics' public policy manager. Together, they have written the piece titled, When Subsidies Work and When They Don't, Food Versus Power. You can read it on our website under the Publications tab.
Now, this paper and debate struck us as particularly important. Not only does it really highlight a major problem in our country, but it happens to be a problem that few people fully understand.
Everyone has heard and has likely even used the word subsidy. But what does it really mean? What does it do? Why do we need them? How do we know they're being used properly?
Well, today we hope to clear up some of this by discussing water and solar subsidies as they apply to the state of California, as well as a possible future framework for the use of the resources that our debaters discussed and agreed upon.
Maybe we can start by defining the word subsidy. I, for one, am not well versed in this area.
Good idea. A subsidy is simply money granted by a government body to help industry or business. The idea is that subsidizing an industry will keep the price of that industry's products or service low.
This can keep products affordable and even maintain healthy competition within an industry.
Oh, that makes sense. So now we can get to the heart of the debate. Unless you live without any connection to the world outside of your living room, you've probably heard that California is suffering from water issues. But it's important to flesh out what in particular these issues are. Economically speaking, the debaters didn't see California suffering from a drought per se, but rather from a water shortage.
Wait. What does that even mean? Why do we keep calling it a drought then? Is there a difference?
Well, these technicalities may be more important than you think. See, the debaters defined a drought as a water shortage that produces significant economic consequences. California, in fact, has an abundant amount of fresh water because the state invests in rainwater collection reservoirs. But issues arise when we don't allocate this water properly.
So the water shortage becomes a drought if we aren't smart about how we use what we have.
So this problem is ours as the average urban consumers? Does the California government have to mandate a 2-minute shower policy? Ooh, maybe they should propose the amendment, thou shall not brush thy teeth with thy water running.
I think they may run into some roadblocks there. Speaking as a Californian, many of us are already trying these water-saving techniques. Here's a funny example. Remember the ice bucket challenge? Many coastal Californians used the absolutely freezing water of the Pacific Ocean rather than waste the water from their tap. No matter what we do, though, it seems like it's not enough.
Yes, both presenters and debaters thought agriculture was most at fault here. The agricultural industry of California uses about 80% of the state's water, which causes pain for everyone down the line.
How can ag facilities afford to be using up all the water when I can get reprimanded for sparing a cup for my windowsill herb garden?
Well, as it turns out, through subsidies, water is provided to the agricultural sector at a much lower price than the rest of us. The debaters saw this subsidized price as so low that water might as well be seen as practically free for the farmers.
And this is a major problem, because while the water situation isn't improving, and California's population continues to grow, the agricultural sector has little incentive to create and use more water-efficient irrigation systems and less water-intensive crops.
Well, we all love our almonds. Do these precious, heart-healthy snacks deserve a place on our shelves if they're drying out California's land for all that it's worth?
Wow, that was dramatic. Actually, the authors and debaters focused more on crops like alfalfa, which use roughly 4.5 acre feet of water per acre of the crop. What's more, the majority of the alfalfa produced won't even directly feed the nation, but it'll instead be used for the meat and dairy industries. And get this, it'll also be shipped across the world to feed cows in China.
So while these water subsidies were created in order to feed the nation and keep food affordable, they seem to be encouraging an awful lot of frivolous use through the tendency to grow these water-intensive crops in highly arid landscapes.
How did this subsidy mess happen in the first place, though?
Well, Dr. Thornburg and Mr. Schrader wrote that in California, water is largely allocated using riparian water rights. By this definition, water is assigned to portions of land on the basis of historical claims, a majority of which were designed when the state was largely agrarian. While agricultural interests still control 80% of California's water, their operations make up less than 2% of the state's economy.
Now, we don't want to be bashing California agriculture here. The country does, in fact, rely heavily on this region for food. The finger should instead, perhaps, be pointed at these outdated water rights and their lack of ability to innovate with changing times.
For example, the debaters fervently discuss the lack of a water market under this current subsidy plan. Those who hold water rights over their particular portion of land can use their allocated water, but they can't sell it to others who may want or desperately need to use it.
Which in turn only intensifies the overuse of water. If you're a farmer and you don't use all the water portion to your land, and there's no way to make a monetary gain, why not just use it all for yourself?
Because you're worried about the degradation of the surrounding environment and the greater good of society?
Wishful thinking, Cleo. Sorry to be all glass half empty here, but it's the truth.
It would certainly be nice if we all individually took it upon ourselves to rid the world of complex and convoluted social and environmental issues, but I think that's a discussion for another day.
What does need to be discussed is the fact that this overuse of water in the agricultural sector is consequently raising prices for urban and industrial users, a point that Dr. Thornburg and Mr. Schrader brought up in their paper, and one discussed highly by debaters.
While these urban and industrial consumers represent the vast majority of California's economy, they are also the ones suffering the most direct consequences of agriculture's overuse. Our authors explain that as costs become higher, some urban areas are forced to invest in expensive technologies, such as desalination plants or dual systems for gray water.
Desalination plants? I mean, drinking the ocean is cool, I guess.
Speaking of oceans, San Diego already has a desalination plant in the works, one that will produce drinkable water at the exorbitant price of at least $1,800 per acre foot.
Although all these negatives seem to be stacking up, we can't leave out the fact that the debaters generally agreed that current water subsidies divert water supply tapping from key life-saving structures, such as reservoirs.
Due to a lack of incentive, it's actually much harder to fill reservoirs in times when water isn't so scarce. We therefore end up using excessive amounts of groundwater in times of desperation, causing stresses to both the land and communities that could have been avoided with better conservation efforts during the good times.
So we've been spending a lot of time on water subsidies because, let's face it, this stuff is complex and downright problematic. But another purpose of this paper is to highlight where subsidies are working.
So let's take a 180 here.
Subsidies are successfully being implemented in the energy sector in regards to solar power and the efforts made to create and expand the use of clean, green energy.
Since 2005, the U.S. has seen a huge growth in solar energy investment, which has resulted in increased efficiency, capability, and integration into our existing infrastructure. For example, Californians receive solar subsidies through various tax rebates and incentive programs.
But didn't the debaters discuss that subsidizing solar energy could result in excessive electricity consumption, just like how current water subsidies encourage high water use?
Jeez, Aubrey, aren't you the negative Nancy today?
Hey, don't shoot the messenger. It's not my fault the debaters talked about it.
Well, yes, they did. But unlike water subsidies, energy subsidies also encourage movement towards cleaner electricity sources. It allows for the industry to grow and become more innovative and effective instead of simply being swallowed up by cheaper traditional energy sources such as coal.
This way, solar energy has a shot at competing against these traditional sources. Dr. Thornburg and Mr. Schrader expressed that the eventual hope is that, down the run, solar energy will become cheaper than other forms of energy. As solar subsidizing continues, companies will be incentivized to produce better, cheaper cells in a competitive market.
Because of this, solar subsidies offer an interesting contrast to water subsidies.
So many subsidies. Let's jump back to the water subsidies for a sec. What can we do about them? Why do important resources like water and energy have subsidy systems that differ so vastly?
Well, first, water is a finite resource that is being undervalued through current subsidies, resulting in a lack of incentive to create ways to save water. Debaters therefore saw an innovative opportunity by opening water markets of California.
These water markets were definitely a hot topic, but how many problems would this course of action really solve?
Well, you see, rather than setting different prices for urban, industrial, and agricultural uses, an open water market would allow prices to rise and fall according to demand. Through this open market system, the price of water would rise during a water shortage, and those who use water for low-value use, like those alfalfa growers, will be most affected.
The debaters wanted to be clear that the idea is not to eliminate alfalfa farmers, but to reallocate resources towards more efficient uses, and to have the production of these low-return, water-intensive crops come at more appropriate market price.
This all sounds great, but won't consumption climb super high when the prices are low?
The debaters argued that this actually wouldn't be the case, especially if conservation efforts are being made to encourage efficient water use.
Okay, but what will be the effect of water prices rapidly decreasing to the price farmers are currently paying?
Well, the debaters said this isn't likely to happen either, because water, relative to its value, is pretty expensive to move. This does mean, however, that different kinds of submarkets, ones carrying different market prices, must be developed.
And this idea is certainly not without its challenges. Without the reserved, subsidized portion of water for the agricultural industry, food prices could fluctuate.
Which is a change that would hit home hardest for the poor.
The debaters did see this as an interesting opportunity, however. Given that 40% of food goes to waste in the U.S., it is not unreasonable for many to assume that food is underpriced and therefore undervalued by the public. Increased prices could, in theory, present opportunities to address food waste as well as food insecurity in more direct ways than water subsidies, perhaps through various poverty reduction programs appropriate to specific areas.
Wow, this debate really did jump all over the place. Water, energy, food waste, what's next?
Well, the debaters were very clear that everyone must be provided with food and water, and that access to one should not be compromised by the other.
In order to make this happen, though, the debaters strongly agreed that policies need to focus on amending California's system of water rights. It's that straightforward. The water supply won't be increased for urban or environmental consumption if the supply reserved for agriculture isn't opened.
It was also noted that water markets must have consistent policies concerning their implementation, and that restriction cannot be relaxed or rewritten during each water shortage.
But what about regulating all of this? We can't just create a water market and walk away.
Swim away?
Very clever, Aubrey. But really, what will the oversight be?
Well, it is clear that these markets must be regulated, but the answer to the problem can take a few avenues. One proposal suggested that policy should support a central oversight process through the creation of a global water agency. This agency would oversee the creation of local and regional water markets that allow for the exchange of resources.
Another suggestion was that policy allow for the free movement of water through both existing and new infrastructure.
Groundwater is a whole other mess, however, since we need to find a way to untangle the obscure rights to common underground aquifers.
Where's the obscurity?
Well, can you say that just because a country rests over top of an aquifer, that it owns the water contained by that aquifer? Plus, how would you delineate what parts of an aquifer were owned by what countries? I mean, we don't say that any one country owns the oceans. It's kind of the same principle.
Yeah, those are the obscurities. It was suggested, though, that we can fix this problem by integrating groundwater into the proposed water market system.
Would pollution mitigation play any part in this new water market?
Yes, actually. The debaters were very interested in the idea of local water markets accounting for their own pollution and conservation issues. If, say, San Diego residents overwater their lawns and create runoff, they should be charged with extra fees to offset the cost of fixing that pollution problem.
The Mojave Water Basin, one of the few open water markets in the state of California, actually offers an example and guideline for future action. Here, former alfalfa farmers are now making money while simultaneously reducing their water waste.
How is this even possible? Making money by getting rid of your waste? Be warned, Cleo, you might have people selling their bathwater if you're not careful.
Well, they're accomplishing this feat by selling or leasing their water rights to local water agencies in the high desert. It was noted, however, that implementing this change in policy took an immense amount of effort.
But clearly the effort paid off and gives us a great outline for expansion of this idea.
Okay, so shifting once more to the subject of solar energy and its subsidies, debaters also saw several opportunities for change. Although, unlike the water issue, these opportunities included expanding existing efficiencies. A primary goal in solar energy research is to store the energy generated at peak sunlight hours in order to use it during peak consumption periods.
This means creating a battery that could gather all kinds of energy from the sun during the middle of the day, and then be ready for you to use it during the mornings and evenings.
And on Mondays. Everyone knows Mondays are bleak.
Figuratively speaking, I'd agree with you.
But as the solar industry grows, we have to make serious efforts to expand the distribution of associated solar technologies, as well as integrate them into existing infrastructure.
For all this to happen, Dr. Thornburg, Mr. Schrader, and the debaters insisted that we need to continue subsidizing consumer investment in the solar industry.
Right, because if these cheaper, dirtier forms of energy, like coal, still exist, consumers are much less likely to afford or even want the cleaner solar energy sources. Not only do we need to subsidize solar, but we must allow for the price of dirtier energy to reflect its externalities. Debaters seem to think that this would in turn encourage consumption of and investment in the integration of clean batteries for solar technology.
Really, though, whether we are talking about water or energy, improvements start with a focus on the public's education regarding these issues. It is vital that the public has the knowledge to interpret information for themselves and make educated decisions on their consumption.
So, if you have any creative suggestions for getting the word out on this highly debated topic...
You know, other than telling every single person you know to tune into the forum...
Exactly.
Let us know, or ask any questions you may have on our Facebook page.
Or, of course, you could use our favorite platform and tweet us at ISGPTweets with hashtag ISGPForum.
That's all we have for this podcast. Thanks for socializing with science today, and we hope to have you back next time on the forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.